Some friends of mine have the most amazing household. They have four biological sons, just adopted a daughter, and are now fostering yet another child. And all six are under 10 years old. You'd imagine this house to be absolute chaos. And don't get me wrong, there is plenty of energy with all of those little ones around. Nonetheless, visiting them is not an experience of chaos. Rather, it's like inserting yourself into a well-oiled machine with oodles of moving parts. The kids are kind and respectful. They follow directions, for the most part, and have good manners. Once, after a whole day with the family, I asked one of the moms how they do it. And she just looked at me and she said, "Prayer." She'd hooked me, of course. You never tell a pastor about prayer without her asking more. I had expected her to tell me about teaching the kids to pray for other people from an early age, or maybe that the golden rule was part of every conversation that they had from little on up. But that wasn't it. Instead, she told me that she makes sure that she has time apart from all of them for 15 minutes every day to cultivate wonder and awe. 15 minutes a day apart from all of them to cultivate wonder and awe. Sometimes it's before her wife leaves for work or after she gets home. Sometimes it's when the littlest ones are napping. The older boys know that when mom puts in her earbuds, that the questions are going to have to wait for 15 minutes. They know that in 15 minutes, she'll be back and be present for them. What does she play on her headphones in those 15 minutes? Sometimes it's Bach and Beethoven. Sometimes it's Mahalia Jackson or some of those other great gospel singers. Sometimes it's Lady Gaga or Jimi Hendrix. And sometimes she confessed to me that she doesn't play anything at all. She just puts the headphones in for her prayer time with no input at all. Nonetheless, having the headphones in is a signal to both herself and the family that this is her sacred time, that this is her time apart to pray. She says that when she comes back from that time, she's refreshed and renewed. She's more centered, better able to be present to all of those needs around her, clearer about her purpose, and rooted in who she is and what she needs to do. Today's gospel is often called the Transfiguration because Jesus is transfigured in front of Peter, James, and John's eyes. In it, we hear of Jesus bringing these three up a mountaintop where they see him transformed before their eyes. His face shines like the sun. His clothes turn into a dazzling white. And then Moses and Elijah appear, the great bringer of the law, and the prophet whose return the Jews were awaiting. Peter's first instinct is to preserve and commemorate and honor what's happening. But the voice of God cuts him off. I love the way that the phrase is written there. It's almost as if God's voice comes right on top of Peter, telling him, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." They have this magnificent, overwhelming experience, which culminates in the declaration of belovedness and the instruction to listen. To listen. The term mountaintop experience doesn't originate here. The passage that Paul read is of another absolutely transcendent mountaintop experience. And ancient literature gives us plenty of other examples. The term refers to those times apart when we engage with wonder and awe, when the magnificence of God's creation takes center stage in our minds, when we're able to step out of our everyday and access the grandeur of God. Often, when we have this experience, it's in nature. It's on a mountaintop or a ski slope. It's on the edge of the Grand Canyon, or whale watching, or at the base of a glacier, or watching the tide roll in. But the peace and calm of my friend's home is a reminder that wonder and awe can also be accessed in the midst of the city, in the midst of our everyday. In her prayer, she actively cultivates the wonder and awe of the mountaintop so that she has the wherewithal to deal with life back here on the plains. The context of Jesus' transfiguration is important here. In chapter 16, Peter finally got it. He'd finally understood that Jesus was the Messiah. So, like any good teacher, Jesus then moved on to the next lesson. Jesus started telling the disciples that he would have to undergo great suffering, and that he would be killed, and that he would rise again. Peter's response is, "God forbid it! Make it stop! Don't let this happen!" And Jesus' response? "Get behind me, Satan." That's what he tells Peter. "Get behind me, Satan." That is what happened just before Jesus took Peter and James and John up the mountain. Similarly, after Jesus and Peter and James and John come down the mountain, there's plenty of drama right away. Jesus first cures a boy who has a demon. Then he foretells his brutal death yet again. And then he gets into it with people about the temple tax. All of that before the end of chapter 17. What I read in this context is how mountaintops give us a perspective when the details of our lives seem to be constricting us and not making sense. What I see in this passage this year is that mountaintops give us the perspective, as well as giving us nourishment, a well of God's peace to access amidst the trials and tribulations of life. Friends, I don't know about you, but I need mountaintop more than ever. Amidst the chaos and the struggle of our lives, amidst the nasty, brutish nature of so much of what's going on in the world, we, like Peter and James and John, need time out. We need time amidst God's magnificence to glean perspective. In 2015, assistant professor at UC Irvine, Paul Piff, and several of his colleagues did a landmark study that they entitled "Awe, the Small Self, and Pro-Social Behaviors." Just a few of their findings show the importance of giving ourselves the time and space to cultivate wonder and awe. Wonder and awe make us feel like we are part of something bigger than ourselves, they found. They say that it makes us feel more connected to other people and the world around us, that wonder and awe enhance our desire to be helpful and reduce our feelings of entitlement. Wonder and awe make us feel smaller and less significant in the grand scheme of things. Wonder and awe remind us that our lives and our circumstances are tiny in comparison to the magnificence of the universe. Wonder and awe shift our self-concept and inspire us to more collaboration and cooperation. Wonder and awe make us more pro-social and less narcissistic. Wonder and awe help us to feel more generous and empathetic to others. They help us to feel that we have more time, which in turn enhances our well-being. They reduce our emphasis on the desires and concerns of the self. They increase our ethical decision-making abilities. And lastly, they deepen our feelings of gratitude and thanksgiving. Makes you want to climb a mountaintop, doesn't it? Friends, we have a lot going on in our lives. There is so much going on in our world. It would be easy to become cynical, to become resentful, to give in to the chaos. But the transfiguration, in the transfiguration, God witnesses to us the power of magnificence, the power of wonder and awe to fuel us and ground us for the days ahead. My prayer for everyone gathered here this week is that we will cultivate wonder and awe, cultivate our sense of the sacred, that we will have the energy and the grounding and the grace to collaborate in God's transforming of the world. May it be so. Amen.